Paper 28, section 6. And I'll tell you the paragraph in a second. For those who have been looking up in the single column, that's old single column, page 315. That first full paragraph at the top of page 315. So it's that last paragraph about the memories of mercy, which is the eighth paragraph of section 6. 28:6-8. If you're looking by paragraph. And so if you recall, last time we got to that point, and it seems like a very curious place to stop, but the time made it desirable, and it is actually a definitive break point. Because up to there, as you recall, last time we had a lot about that judgment thing. And worrying about salvation and what judgment and what have you, and the capital J judges, the Ancients of Days, and all those issues. A little less of that tonight, and definitely here in this subsection about the memories of mercy, there's this definitive transition. So they've passed through that, and now they're going to pick up on that question of, well, do these Sakonophim do anything besides sort of what's directly tied to the little, you know, passages that they give us in here about each one? And the answer is yes, they do countless things that they can't even begin to describe to us. But certainly one of the things that they do, they're about to transition to with the memories of mercy, is they teach us. You know, by and large, when you're talking about a revelation that is limited to revealing that which is directly related to the ascension scheme, it shouldn't be too surprising that most of the beings that are talked about in here are going to be our teachers in one way or another at some point in the whole process. You have a few of their superiors and whatnot that have to be mentioned in order to have a full picture of everything. But but so much of what's revealed is there so that there can be an ascension scheme. All of the countless things that have to go into making that happen. And obviously lots and lots of education is going to be required to take something that starts out as lowly as this and somehow get it to be able to stand in the presence of infinite, you know, persons and somehow have some recognition of them. That's a vast educational process. So yes, they do. And so when they, you know, get into that mode of telling you about how some being is educating you, you know, you shouldn't be surprised if the revelator that's doing the telling is going to find every opportunity to educate you while he's telling you about your future educators. And, you know, this is one of the seminal examples in the entire revelation of a paragraph that gives you a very important illustration of the levels of meaning. You know, those levels of mind functioning, those levels of associativity, you know, meaning, things, meanings, values, when you look in the threefold actuality, you know, that middle block with meanings, the associative block there. Okay, so, and in that, because it's such an educational and important paragraph, you know, years ago I made a couple of little handouts that relate to the content of this. Which you guys have, and I believe Katie has put the links up like she did last week. If she hadn't, those links to those two papers that are on the website. So for those who are on the webinar, okay, they're the ones that are on the way. If you go to the library on the website, Perfecting Horizons Library, down at the bottom of the writings page, there's a group of little handouts that I made about the levels of meaning. And there's one about selfhood to personality that we're going to be looking at tonight. And then the one, it's just, I think it's called Cosmic Meaning. It's just a short heading there on the website. It's Cosmic Expressions of the Six Levels of Meaning. We're going to be looking at one of those cosmic expressions of the six levels of meaning and, you know, explaining what that means. So let's get this paragraph read, and then I'll slowly lead us through it here, and we'll see how much, you know, really powerful content there is, you know, in terms of setting a foundation for your understanding of the levels of meaning.
The Mercy Reflectors, with their tertiary associates, engage in numerous super universe ministries, including the teaching of the ascending creatures. Among many other things, the significance of origins teach these ascenders how to apply spirit ethics. And following such training, the memories of mercy teach them how to be truly merciful. While the spirit techniques of mercy ministry are beyond your concept, you should even now understand that mercy is a quality of growth. You should realize that there is a great reward of personal satisfaction in being first just, next fair, then patient, then kind. And then, on that foundation, if you choose and have it in your heart, you can take the next step and really show mercy. But you cannot exhibit mercy in and of itself. These steps must be traversed. Otherwise, there can be no genuine mercy. There may be patronage, condescension, or charity, even pity, but not mercy. True mercy comes only as the beautiful climax to these preceding adjuncts to group understanding, mutual appreciation, fraternal fellowship, spiritual communion, and divine harmony.
Okay. Now, first of all, notice two things in terms of talking about the word mercy. Two modifiers. You notice that in the midst of there, towards the end, they use the expression genuine mercy. And then earlier on, you know, they talked about the memories of mercy teaching us how to be truly merciful, or in other words, true mercy. Okay. So when you're reading the Revelation, when you see a word with the adjective genuine in front of it, like genuine happiness or genuine love or genuine meekness or anything like that, they're trying to remind you that there is a vast potential for misunderstanding in play. That in many cases, humans have been striving but haven't even gotten close yet to the genuine meaning of this word that they use all the time. You know, they haven't coined a word. They've taken a word that we all use, but they're saying, we're trying to reveal to you what that word means in the cosmic system. You're pulling words out of the cosmic system, consciousizing them in English in our case, and expressing them as a sequence of letters. What does that sequence of letters actually tie to in the cosmic system? So there's something that we're trying to figure out that is genuine mercy. And then there's also something higher than that called true mercy. Okay, the word true is referring to the fact that you're now thinking of the full cosmic system. You're now thinking of the triunity, or the threefold actuality with unity. You're thinking about how you have individuality and unity woven together, and there's a superadditive consequence that is literally the relationship between the two. You know, that system. In that context of the universal harmony, there are concepts that have multiple facets, like mercy, that stem from their what we can experience as an evolutional precursor. You know, they're building blocks. So what starts out as rungs on a ladder going up the levels of meaning, like you heard me say many times, you know, picture when you get to the sixth level of meaning, when you get to the top rung, imagine lifting that ladder up. You're not going to burn the ladder behind you. You're going to lift it up, and you're going to put it on a first genuine cosmic level that you're going to begin to think on. And you're going to wrap that linear ladder image into a circle, connect the two ends, and create a multifaceted, instead of a multi-runged, it's now a multifaceted cosmic structure that you're going to be able to manifest. You know, that's derived from those now harmonized, systematized former stepping stones, you know, up the, or rungs up the ladder. Okay, so the first thing is that ladder. Let's try to figure out what genuine mercy is. Okay, well now, if you look at that selfhood to personality chart, you see on the right the reference to where the levels of meaning are introduced formally as quote-unquote levels of meaning, you know, up in part 4, in paper 147, section 4, that reference you see there. And, you know, it's stated that there's these levels of meaning. So I've got that there for parallel reference. And then you can see what I've done there is I've shown this illustration that they just introduced us to, an illustration of the levels of meaning. And I've filled in the rest of it. I've given you the zeroth level as well, the foundation, where you start with law. And then, you know, you notice that they gave you that sequence of first just, next fair, then patient, then kind, and then merciful. See, so now, you know, putting it in this, this mode of not the nouns, you know, so you have law, and then, of course, the, you know, application of laws, justice. That's pretty obvious that that's, you know, the next notch up. So you go law, justice, and then there's fairness, and then patience, and then kindness, and then mercy on the fifth level of meaning. And then, of course, what lies above that? Love on the sixth level of meaning. So this, you know, this is one of the most immediately useful of the illustrations of the levels of meaning. They refer to it countless times all over in the book, where if you don't know that hierarchy of facts, you know, of words, concepts, you can't even begin to understand what they're talking about. For instance, you can't understand what they say about the Beatitudes. The whole discussion of the Beatitudes is a discussion about the physics of the levels of meaning. You know, that whole extended discussion, that's all about, the physics of the levels of meaning. Going into all the complexities of it, including bringing in the true facets of things. In that case, the true facets of character, your personalized self's character. Okay, anyway, just in the little annotations that I put below that, law, justice, fairness, patience, kindness, mercy, love, you know, in the square brackets there, to give you an initial sense of, as you're growing, you know, notice they said while the spirit techniques of mercy ministry are beyond your concept, you should even now understand that mercy is a quality of growth. You grow up to the fifth level of meaning, the level of mercy. What does that growth look like? Well, I mean, the Father established you, you know, God is law, as an individual. And on that foundation, you start out with selfishness. You know, you start on that very immature level. Everyone does. Why do you start on that level? Because it's the only way. It's the Father's way. You can't skip that level. You, like they're saying, you'll never get up to mercy. You'll never even get up to the second level of meaning if you don't have the first level of meaning. Because the farthest that an evolving creature can step in stepping up that ladder is one step. You can't step up two steps. Your legs aren't long enough. You'll never even get to fairness if there isn't a level of justice. And as an immature child, that starts out as selfishness. And then it moves up to that next level of a mutual self-focus. You know, so think about it. It starts out with an inward-pointing arrow, a definitive inward-pointing arrow, and that's all there is in your universe, me. Me. And then you get a little bit more mature, and you go, okay, I'll let the arrow point at you for a little bit, as long as it can point back to me again in a little bit, because that's only fair. Okay, you know, so the first time a little kid says fair, see, they've gotten up to that level of growth. They're starting to not think wholly selfishly. It's still an inward-pointing arrow, but they're willing to share the inward-pointing arrow, mutual self-focus. That's the level of fairness. Now, just pause for a second, and I'll remind you that in another place where Jesus gives another illustration of the levels of meaning, when he's talking about the fear of the Lord, he reminds us that, by and large, all of us are just functioning on the first two levels of meaning. Okay, no matter if we're biologically 70, mindily, you know, he says, most of you aren't even getting up to the next level, the level of mind. You're stuck there on the level of the flesh and the level of the feelings. And you feel like you're doing something enlightened and transcendent when you do the level of feelings. You know, and you call it religious or something. Okay, but you think about in society how this expresses. You know, if you're in that, still functioning in that level of the flesh, you're out there pounding on something saying, I demand justice. It's nothing in the universe but an inward pointing arrow. The first word in your sentence is, I demand justice. You know, not let me foster a more just society. No, it's I demand justice. Okay, so it's the first level of meaning. And then, you know, then the really enlightened people, quote unquote, you know, you hear constantly saying, you know, pointing to fairness. It's like, well, that's only fair. I mean, we have to do that for the sake of fairness. I mean, you hear the word fairness just endlessly, like in political discourse. Like this is a very advanced thought to be suggesting fairness. Okay, second level of meaning. And like Jesus so sharply reminds us, the third level of meaning is the level of mind, he says. So in other words, I find you sub-minded, to paraphrase what he says in that. By and large, he says you're sub-minded in the eyes of the universe. You're just using your first six adjutants. You're on the first two levels of meaning. And at best, you're feeling something. It's your thoughts, not your feelings, that leads you Godward. We have to get up there to number six. That's where we see the word God. Okay. So then you move up to the next level. And if you're doing this in the hourglass analogy, we've been down in the lower domain of the hourglass, the foundation, you know, the floor of that lower domain of the hourglass is the zeroth level of meaning, level of law. Okay, and we've been working our way up. And now we're at the middle of the neck of the hourglass on the third level of meaning, the level of patience. And that's a level of self-neutrality. Now, the arrow isn't pointing inward anymore, but it's not pointing outward yet either. It's been neutralized for the first time. Okay? You're on a threshold. See, that's the beauty of the hourglass analogy. You're on a threshold of a whole new domain of consciousness. Okay? That level of self-neutrality, level of patience. And as you go up, now you're going to start turning the arrow outward. Okay, the level of kindness. Now, when Jesus is illustrating the golden rule, when he introduces the levels of meaning up there in paper 147, he calls that fourth level the level of brotherly love, because that's the most immediate to his particular illustration, to call it that. And why is there an immediate relationship between calling it the level of brotherly love and the level of kindness? Well, what does the word kindness literally mean? It literally means kin likeness. That's where that word comes from. To be kind is to be kin-like in your association, the level of brotherly love, which, of course, turns around and reminds you that that's what brotherly love means. It means kindness. Every time you see brotherly love, you can replace that technically with the word kindness. You know, for instance, in the love your neighbor passage, you know, that's a brotherly love passage, not a sixth level of meaning passage. Dangerous to interpret it there. It's a brotherly love passage. It's be kind to your neighbor as you are kind to yourself. If you think it's literally fatherly love, sixth level of meaning love, that's Luciferian. That's self-love. Love of self. Okay. You got to know it's a fourth level thing. Don't overinterpret it or become all good things taken to extremes become bad. Okay, it's a level of brotherly love, a level of kindness. And that's a mutual self-sacrifice. Think of a family. That's the whole point. You say, okay, I'm going to point my arrow outward. I will sacrifice for your sake. I'll sacrifice some self-interest for your sake. But I expect you to do the same in return because we're family. Okay, it's a mutual self-sacrifice, a mutual outward arrow. And you go up to the next notch, the level of mercy. Now you've finally reached selflessness. The arrow is just pointing out with no expectation of anything in return. It's an outward pointing arrow. And now that you've got an outward pointing arrow, you're going to give it God-likeness. You're going to take it up the next notch. You're going to make that direction godlike direction. You're going to purpose it with your purposing ability, with your personality, in its full mode now. A purposed, directed, outward arrow. Love, that dynamic word, you know, that God is. Love, that dynamic outward arrow. Okay, so, see, it's a steep order even to get to the top.
Yep. Where do you think forgiveness comes in
here? That's another discussion, but I'll throw it in really quick. That's forgiveness comes in as one of the six facets of cosmic character. And forgiveness, see, genuine forgiveness, see, that's the thing, you know, there's all kinds of lowly notions of forgiveness. When you finally get it up to its full cosmic proper sense, it is patient love. You know, think of the forgiveness of God. What kind of forgiveness is that? It's a forgiveness that never took offense in the first place. That's God-likeness. If you think that the genuine, you know, or even the cosmic meaning of the word forgiveness has something to do with, okay, I found offense in that, and now I got to try to somehow rise up against my instincts to. And retaliate or no, you're missing the whole point. It's patient love. You're just going to love that person like the Father does from an eternity perspective. How patient is a being who's in eternity? Pretty darn patient. Has no notion of time to be impatient relative to. That's God-likeness. Take time out of it. Love them independent of time. That's forgiveness. That's true forgiveness. Okay, and it's in a construct of cosmic construct of the other facets of cosmic character. It's another one of those handouts you can look at. I talk about that. But so there you have the basic structure. They're saying that this whole bit about how do they word that? Personal satisfaction. See, you have to get all the way up to the sixth level of meaning where you've brought in not only all the adjutants, but the three cosmic intuitions, you can see that are building those top three levels, so that you have a full personalizable system that can be encompassed by your personality. And the satisfaction in your mind when you as a person have encompassed the triunity and have begun to master it and direct it in godlike fashion is sublime. That's what you're looking for. All right, now, like I said, like so many things, like think about the word love, you know, where it actually is on the sixth level of meaning. That's where that word has its place. You know, and it starts out on the level of the flesh in many people's mouths. You know, that a lot of people, that's why the revelators say we pain to use those four letters. Because we know, you know, many of you think that's at best a second level of meaning word. You think love is a noun. You think love is a feeling at best. And a lot of you aren't even that far. You think it is something to do with, you know, physical issues. Like lust. Okay. Another four-letter word that starts with L, but not the same one. Okay. It's like, no. And we just saw that. As you bring that word love up, you know, the use of it, bring its meaning up to where it's actually anchored at the sixth level. As it passes through the fourth level, you could call it brotherly love. But that's just kindness. Actual love, fatherly love, is up on the sixth level of meaning. And it's a huge distance. Like they remind you when they talk about father, brotherly and fatherly love up in the Jesus papers. That is a massive challenge to get something up from kindness through mercy to love. Okay, but let's just focus on mercy here. And they said, well, what happens with this thing that is really seated up on the fifth level of meaning and is then genuinely mercy? When you have initial inkling that there's this thing that you want to call mercy, and you declare something that you're doing merciful, what is it actually? Well, they gave you those sequence of words. Okay, if you're calling it mercy, but it's actually on the first level of meaning, what is it actually? It's patronage. Okay, if it's on the first level of meaning, it's patronage. It's like, well, why? Well, think of that. With patronage, you are holding on to a vertical differential of relationship to the person for whom you are a patron. You're superior, they're inferior. Okay, that's patronage. That superiority, inferiority is an important part of the meaning of the word patronage. It doesn't mean that, you know, you aren't, you know, helping them a lot, but you're staying up here and you're not going down there where they are. Okay? You're handing them money or whatever down to them. Okay, that's patronage. Okay? If you actually go down to their level, descend until you're with, you know, the con part, descend until you're with them. Okay, so that there's a mutual nature, you're on the second level of meaning, okay, in a pheromone. Okay, so you might call that being merciful, you know, and many religious people, for instance, call that merciful. No, that's condescension. You're a long ways from mercy yet. Long ways from mercy yet. That's just merely condescension. It's like, well, okay, well, let me take it up a notch. Charity. Well, charity, that's like the biggest word possible. No, that's the third level of meaning. You still got a long ways to go. So now a lot of people will call charity mercy, being merciful. Okay, well, now why is that the third level of meaning? Think about charity. What you're doing there is you're doing it in you're neutralizing the self component. I give to charity, and the charitable organization takes care of the people that are down there in the trenches. You know, I'm not, you know, in a person-to-person looking down, but I've kind of taken that whole interaction out. I'm giving to charity. I'm being charitable. Just kind of spreading it around in a sort of a self-neutral way. Okay? That's charity. And then you can see, you know, even though now it's obvious, but in the context of this paragraph, when you don't immediately recognize this as the levels of meaning and all that, you know, you go, why did they say even pity? What's the even word about? See, they're running you. You can even take it up to the fourth level of meaning, but even then, it's not the fifth. Okay? Now, why is what's often called mercy But it's actually on the fourth level of meaning, so it's actually just pity. Why is it called, why is that actually pity? Okay, pity has the same root as piety. Now, here's an example. We're not talking about a dimly recognized pity. You need to know genuine pity here. The revelators always use the genuine meanings of words. So you got to know what it genuinely means, not its corrupted meanings. Genuine pity, like I said, is literally the same root as piety. See how close the words are. And piety is more than just devotion to God. It also implies devotion to family. Ding, 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 ding. The level of kindness, the level of kin-likeness, the level of brotherly love. Okay? See? That's pity. Okay? But you got to go above that. You got to go above the level of kin-likeness, above the level of family relationship. You got to go up to the fifth level of meaning. Okay? And the extent to which that's inscrutable is the extent to which you know you have a challenge. Figure out, it's like, well, take something like love or whatever. Well, how high, am I really using that word? How high in the levels of meaning have I gone with that? Have I thought I've reached the ceiling and stopped trying to take it up because, you know, because I just declared that by fiat I'm as high as you can go? What could be higher than a feeling, a deep, passionate feeling? Well, four other levels of meaning, that's what. Not to mention actual human quality of consciousness instead of fancy animal stuff. Merely feeling is just fancy animal stuff. Like Jesus said, that's submindal, subhuman mind in the eyes of the universe. Celestials definitely call that a child of God. If you're going to be genuinely merciful, you're going to need to take it up above the child level. You're going to have to start being an adult of God to some degree. You've got to start to go beyond the fourth epical revelation, you know, and just out of grace of being a child, you've got to do something as well as be something. And it's like, well, how do I go about that? How do I understand that? Well, they've given us a whole textbook on the philosophy of the cosmos, you know, the physics of the levels of meaning and whatnot. Okay, so that's what's going on there. They're just showing you what those, just like they, you know, in a sense, see, they've shown you what the proper words for love are. If it's on the first level of meaning, it's not actually love, it's justice. If it's on the second level of meaning, it's not actually love, it's fairness. If it's on the third level of meaning, it's not actually love, it's patience, etc. Yeah. Okay.
I'm lost.
It's just you know, the idea is just to get the ideas in front of you and then spend several years reflecting on it, like I have, until it begins to feel natural. Yeah, I'm just giving you the basics and you can just start reflecting on it and begin to wrap your mind around it. Now, notice what they do at the end there, what they promised. They said that they were you know, talking about what the memories of mercy do and about teaching us to be truly merciful. Well, they're going to explain to us what true mercy is. What happens to the concept of mercy if you get all the way up to the sixth level of meaning and pull the ladder up and make facets of a cosmic structure on a cosmic level? Remember how going up to psychic circles is going up cosmic levels? See, so like getting started with the psychic circles, you got to get up to the sixth level of meaning first and get on the first cosmic level in a definitive way, on the, you know, seventh psychic circle, and start moving those cosmic levels up. Okay, what does it look like? Well, they've given you it. Okay, and that's the other little handout here. There's three fun little examples of the levels of meaning brought up into cosmic facets. We're just going to do the third one here on this cosmic expressions. The true mercy one, facets of true mercy. The other two you can see here in the Lucifer papers. Very important ones about self-control and personal responsibility. you know, that's in the no greater problem as a result of, yeah, the true and false liberty section. Very important ones. Okay, but see that. Notice what they say. True mercy comes only as the beautiful climax of these preceding adjuncts, right? See, so you got those adjuncts, the levels of meaning. What's the climax? What's beyond that? Climbing the ladder of the levels of meaning. Well, it's the facets of true mercy. And they give them to you in a related to the levels meaning of bottom-up order so that you can quickly figure it out. Group understanding, mutual appreciation, fraternal fellowship, spiritual communion, and divine harmony. Okay, those, true mercy is when you have all five of those at the same time in a harmonious system. Not sequentially or something, but you do all five of them simultaneously. Just like you do individuality and associativity and unity simultaneously in the triunity, in the threefold actuality with unity. You do science, philosophy, and religion at the same time, not separately, etc. You have moda consciousness. Okay, so you can quickly see why they relate to the levels of meaning, like I indicated in the numbers in parentheses there. Group understanding, okay, that is rooted in the first level of meaning, because, how can I immediately appreciate that? Well, the level of the flesh, the first level of meaning, is established by the first, second, and third adjutants. Okay? The first, second, and third adjutants, if I look on the chart here, the second adjutant is called the spirit of understanding. Okay? Understanding, that's a first level of meaning word. Okay? Second adjutant. Mutual appreciation. Okay, this is, and all of these, when you figure out the facets, they all have this interesting, you're linking the upper domain and the lower domain of the hourglass together through the neck. So that third level of meaning is this, ligament that connects the two, and it always gets bound to one of them. So now, the way you understand what's happened here, you see the mutual, like the mutual self-focus of the second level of meaning, but the appreciation. The other illustration that he gives when he does fear and love, Jesus, that is, he gets up to the fifth level of meaning, and it's a level of appreciation. That's the one that goes from anguish to dread across the first, and awe and reverence across the second, and then recognition, and then realization, and then appreciation, and then love. Another way to get to love. Only that one starts at fear. That's the fear to love one. Okay? But the level of mercy, that fifth level, is the level of appreciation also. See, so come so remember, this is the mercy. So you want to fundamentally bring that inner life level of mercy down into the second level of meaning, where it can reach out and engage others. It's your inner life. You got to be able to get to the outer life. So you got to bring it down to the outer domain and out, where there's that mutuality linkage. See, so that's what. So through the neck. See, so through the third level, you've brought it down to the second. So that's how you've established this one. The appreciation has come down through three and bonded to two. And then the fourth level, fraternal fellowship. Well, fraternal, okay, brotherly. That one's obvious, fourth level of meaning. Spiritual communion. Okay, now why the word communion tied to the fifth level? See, it's that inner life communion, that spiritual communion. Why is that tied to the fifth level? Well, it's the level of selflessness. The fifth level, okay? So you've taken self out of the picture. You were slowly working up in that growth till you finally got self out of the picture. Well, if selves are out of the picture, then everything is in common. It's a common space. Communion. That's what the word communion means, that you're in a common space. And, in particular, see, you're in the spiritual, the unity. You are just, all together in common spiritually, because in that facet, because it's selfless. And then divine harmony, well, the divine, the godlikeness, okay? Like I mentioned, what did you achieve when you got all the way up to the sixth level of meaning? You finally now can encompass the whole thing with your personality and establish the harmony. You know, when you look on the threefold actuality with unity, you know, harmony is down there in the fullness of personality. Okay, so you have fundamentally, you see, it begins with that divine harmony now, and then all the other facets are built around it like that. Okay, and you can see the mercy, like I was saying, it's the facets of true mercy, because the mercy is in action. See, that's the one that's in action there on the second level going out, that mutual appreciation. So that's how it works. That's how you unpack these cosmic facets. And you can do the same thing with the self-control and personal responsibility. And like I said, if you go to that other handout, you can do that with your cosmic character. You know, what are you like when you've, you know, gotten all the way up and taken a hold of yourself? What do you look like when you have begun to master that animal origin self? What do you look like when you have character, cosmic character? It has facets. And you can see how they, you know, if you study that, how they tie to the, what originated in levels of growth. Another way, so just that whole bit about how the levels of growth lead to some eventuated encompassment and a new beginning. You know, if the psychic circles are cosmic levels, when you actually get all the way up those cosmic levels, there's going to be some encompassment into some indivisible new starting point, you know, and you go from there. That's why they constantly use that level analogy all over in the book, because you're doing a series, you know, of growth steps, going up levels, and then you encompassment and you begin anew. You encompassment and you begin anew.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting or semantical in a way for me that I noticed that the sixth level of love drives the first, second, third, fourth, fifth level. In other words, I probably wouldn't go through this process if I didn't have the feeling of love to begin with, in terms of, as you say, learning.
Think of it as a spark.
Yeah, right.
Because where does it, you know, God is love. What God are we talking about there? God the Father. The Father is the initiator. Remember, he gave you the personality. He gave you that initiating thing, just like you're seeing there. You know, what sparks it? And the thing that you recognize, see, is long before you actually have gotten up to the sixth level of meaning, you have this vague inkling that there's this word you want to use, L-O-V-E. And that's exactly what the Father wants you to do, to start trying to do that love thing, even when you're on the first level of meaning and are really clueless of what it genuinely means. And then just stay humble and keep working it up. And one day, you will recognize genuine love as the verb that it is and not the noun. Love is something that you do.
Well, as a dad, you know, I noticed that I can, it seems to be a little bit easier for me, you know, with my children to be able to, it's not as much of an effort as it is with my ex-wife, let's say. I didn't mean to throw that.
Well, you can see that.
Green.
You can see it right in the chart. And what they just said, you know, they said, how do they say, first just, next fair, then patient, then kind. Okay, you can't get to the sixth level of meaning except going through the level of kindness. Well, if you have no kin, that could be difficult. So why is the experience of, you know, having a relationship, male and female, and that experience of raising children, the two things that you can't skip to get away from Gerasim?
Right.
Yeah. You got to get up through the level of kindness. It's the only way.
When you speak of selflessness, it is non-self. It is selfless, not to eliminate the self. The self is now an active participant on equal level, but it is still self, only in a different perspective and driving in a different direction.
The work is important.
The work
the
is
self
important.
Is not. See that
the
line.
The self is important.
That's the level of
the
selflessness.
The self is important in with respect to the work, but it's not. It's still there. The self is employed in a different way rather than gimme. It is.
Like I said, it's the outward arrow.
It's outward arrow, but it's still there. It's not non-self. It's selfless.
Yeah, and that's extremely important. Now, I'll just mention that before we go on to the important time here, so we don't want to spend all night on just this. But yeah, it would be a great point, Joe, to emphasize. The one thing I didn't mention there, how did that all start? It started with individuality. The preeminence of the individual. The Father made you an individual, and that's what he expects you to be forever. Don't ever de-individuate yourself in this process. So kind of like, you know, the way of saying what Joe is just saying there, you know, you're going to be selfless, but you're going to be more of an individual than you were before when you started. And we've talked about that. That's the whole process of your ascension scheme. The first thing, you know, you have seven mansion worlds and then Gerasim. Why? Because it takes that many worlds to get you definitively individuated morontially. Before that, you're too fuzzy. Okay? You need to be rock solid individuated as in a morontial sense. And then they take you up a notch and socialize now those definitive individuals. Yeah, you have to be an individual first before they can be social. Because if you're nothing, there is no relationship between two nothings, let alone a system of nothings. You have to be a something first, a definitive Marantia individual. Then you can have a bring it up to the social level. And you get to the ceiling, the Marantia ceiling of unity. It's like, okay, I'm done. No, you're going to encompass that and you're going to start all over again. We're going to rock solid individuate you spiritually. And now you got to start all over again. So now you're a spiritual individual. Now you got to go up through associativity and unity. And now you're on the headquarters of the super universe. It's like, well, now I'm done, right? No. Now you're going to start all over again. Only we're going to really go for it now. We're going to turn everything upside down. We're going to put the unity on the floor now. And you're going to move up from that unity foundation in Havona up through a transcendent unit or a transcendent associativity you can't even imagine right now, up to an individuality that's beyond conception, in an infinite way, practically an individual that is so individuated that you can be an absolute individual on the aisle and have a relationship with the infinite Father. You have to be absolutely individuated, at least existentially, in order to have a individual relationship with the existential Father, because he only relates to individuals. He doesn't relate to fuzzy nothings. From his perspective, you have to be an absolute something, really individuated. You have to be what he started you out as that lowly material individual on the zeroth level of meaning. All right, so now that should transition to the time. It's like, well, wow, that sounds like it's going to take a lot of time. Yeah, and there's an import to time, and that's the next set of Sakanafim here. Let's read them.
Three, the import of time. Time is the one universal endowment of all will creatures. It is the one talent entrusted to all intelligent beings. You all have time in which to ensure your survival, and time is fatally squandered only when it is buried in neglect, when you fail so to utilize it as to make certain the survival of your soul. Failure to improve one's time to the fullest extent possible does not impose fatal penalties. It merely retards the pilgrim of time in his journey of ascent. If survival is gained, all other losses can be retrieved.
Okay, so little shades of that stuff we were talking about last time. Just think about, you know, that first sense of fatally squandered and how that's not in play anymore, like we talked about post-Pentecost. If you didn't have an adjuster so that you didn't have an initial embryonic soul by grace, wow, time would be a real important thing, even in this mortal life, would it not? You need to somehow do what you need to do to get an adjuster in this short little life. You know, and if it was a long time ago, it could be a really short little life before the spears come flying over the, you know, the walls of your fortress. You know, you have to try to somehow get an adjuster so you can have at least an embryonic soul, or fatally squandered is well, your time. Yeah, well, but see, that you got an adjuster to be spear-fused. Remember, they give you a temporary adjuster to make an initial embryonic soul, which infuses with a spirit. Yeah. I mean, you're not going to get anywhere, spirit-fused, son-fused, father-fused, without an adjuster at some, you know, during the mortal life. Okay, at least.
You're just adjuster practice.
Right. So like I said, you know, a lot of what we read in here, take it out of this life. It's not that immediately relevant, a lot of this stuff, to this life. You know, where this really comes into play is you fatally squandering your time is in the next series of lives on the mansion worlds. Okay? You know, because, you know, until you fuse, survival is gained. Okay? You know, the time thing is fatally and potentially in play. Okay? You know, you can't be on the mansion worlds forever. There's a time limit. They give you as much time as you will need, but that doesn't mean endless time. The imports of time figure out how much time it's going to take you, and if you try to take longer than that, you're out of time. Okay? Because it's like, well, that's all the time that you could ever need. I gave you all the time that you could need. Okay? That's the kind of insight we're talking about here. These angels can actually look at that and say, it's going to take Chris Halverson X amount of time to do this. It's like, well, what about all the imponderables of his personality? No. They can encompass all that. You know, and they can say it's going to take that much time. Period.
Would you speak to the first sentence a little bit?
Mm-hmm. The fun thing that they're doing in there, for those who know, even the Bible, is they're playing off the parable of the talents, of course. You know, and the servant who was given one talent and didn't capitalize on it, didn't profit from it. Those evil words like capital and profit, maybe not so evil. They're invoking again. And what did that servant do? He buried it in the ground? Squandered only when it is buried in neglect. Mm-hmm. Pun intended.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Right. So they're referring to that teaching that even Jesus gave us.
Basically, you're still a rebel if that's your attitude. I mean, and there's a lot of people, they don't realize that they're a rebel, you know?
Well, just focus in on that.
Right.
So when you go to the Beatitudes, is there one on humility? Yes, there is.
Right.
Part of the eightfold way of the Beatitudes, right?
Right.
And about humility, right? You're not going to get anywhere. Zero if you're not humble. If you don't start by using that personality the Father gave you to put yourself in cooperative subordination.
Right.
To law.
Well, it seems like this first life, though, because you're talking about this most applies the import of time once we get beyond this first step. So maybe this first step in this planet is maybe to get is to just, get on board, you know?
Well, I mean, you can still squander the opportunity to do things that you can only do during a mortal life.
Oh, okay.
Okay? I mean, and that's irretrievable.
Yeah.
But just on that issue of survival, I mean, Jesus and Michael changed the laws about that.
Right.
So it's not really in play, per se, during the mortal life.
Challenges interest-bearing, whether you like it or not.
Right. You know, and like I've pointed out, there's a flip side to this import of time. The fact that you're given such a short period of time to live during this life, have you thought about how much grace there is in the shortness of your life? Is it not a wonderful gift that I really can't live long enough to become iniquitous? I'm not good enough at it. to become iniquitous in this short life by and large. I mean, it is a supreme individual that can achieve iniquity in this short little life. I mean, yeah, and I'm using the word supreme purposely. I mean, you know, in a sad to record way, you go, wow, that's amazing. How did he do that? I couldn't muster that level of supreme action in this life. I was trying to do it in the positive sense. But, I mean, just to do it in any sense, to achieve supreme action in this short life.
And his name has been eschewed throughout the universe.
I mean, it's, okay, it's, you know, so just, you know, keep that in mind, that it's really important that we're given just a short period of time when we're this ignorant. I mean, why do primitive humans live such a short period of time? And so, I mean, it's merciful.
So we're in other words, they calculate our amount of time it takes if we're faithful, like the two faithful ones that yeah. had the two five talents and the 10 talents.
Right.
If we're faithful, but if we have varying degrees of squandering.
Right. Over here, they mentioned at the beginning of the Memories of Mercy, every soul who really desires divine citizenship, you know, right. statements like that. I mean, if you have any,
yeah.
you know, positive, okay, you'll have more than enough time. Okay. You won't use up all the time if you have any positiveness to your...
So in other words, that's probably a person who's trying, but they get disappointed, you know.
They've taken into account...
Slow,
right. These imports of time taken into account mm-hmm. every possible retardation and misdirection and everything. Okay. You know, there's no way that you can, you know, get, you know, gypped on it. Okay, let's read some more here.
In the assignment of trusts, the counsel of the imports of time is invaluable. Time is a vital factor in everything this side of Avona and Paradise. In the final judgment before the Ancients of Days, time is an element of evidence. The imports of time must always afford testimony to show that every defendant has had ample time for making decisions, achieving choice.
Okay, and you know, and they will. And I just, you know, quickly in passing, that little statement at the very end is, for instance, why you can very, very much suspect that a child who's resurrected on the probationary nursery, that body that is built for them has a lifespan of basically 20 years. That child, you know, the imports of time know how this works. Okay, see, notice how they say that, achieving choice, age 20, the age of choice, if everything is well constructed. Like if you're an Adamite, then definitively 20 is the age of choice. Remember, it was very definitive when the transport angels came to take away Adam and Eve's children. The age of choice, age 20. You know, it's going to be the same definitiveness, and there's not going to be any genetic, you know, goofiness in the body they build for you, you know, that child in the probationary nursery. It's going to chug along just as it should to the age of choice, you know. And so if you haven't chosen, you know, off the body goes. Body turns itself off.
A different environment than here.
Right, right, right. See, it doesn't have any of the issues, right? See, so it can, in very, you know, that's, see, you know, how fast can you get someone to that definitive point? Well, if the environment and the genetics are completely managed, 20. That's all it takes. You know, just like how fast could the life carriers get you evolve will creatures if, you know, they didn't have to strike step with all of the vicissitudes and details? You know, it wouldn't take hundreds of millions of years. It would be done in a very short period of time. It's the exact same thing, that evolutional or developmental, you know, growth. So that's why, you know, I'm
16 or 20.
Well, they're nurtured up through 16, basically, because 16 is when you separate mindily from your parents, and so now you actually can become an independent ascender. But then they say, you know, they're kind of fuzzy about that. See, they want you to kind of put this together. But what happens between 16 and something or other? Because they say that if you get to a certain age and you haven't made the choice, then you die, and that's the end. There's no resurrection from that death. You know, they tell you that. And so then you have to figure out, it's like, well, what would that time, you know, how old would that be? It's like, well, I think it's the age of choice. I think it's 20. You know, and you kind of see that in this wording here.
What does that mean, though, Chris, age of choice? Like, our children?
For us, it probably doesn't mean a heck of a lot because we're far from Adamic.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but because I'm thinking, like, how many kids have really chosen God by the time they're 20?
Well, and again, they don't need to. Again, we don't have any of those things in play. It's not Old Testament anymore. Everyone has a soul by grace. Pentecost. These issues just aren't in play here.
There's additional choices, though.
Yeah, there's all kinds of other things. But the salvation question has been taken off the table. You can talk about all the infinite other things, you know, that are of value about immortal life. But the salvation question is off the table now.
The issue is
those laws are not in play anymore.
Actually grow spiritually after 20.
Yeah. Now, and you know, in terms of these sorts of things that used to be salvation issues, if you spend your whole life twisting your initial embryonic soul of grace, and then they resurrected that misshapen, twisted thing on the first mansion world, you know, it may not go very well for you, you know, on that first mansion world. You may spiral and burn up on the first mansion world, you know, because you've got yourself so twisted to start with, okay? Even with all the guidance, you know, if you get too twisted, you know, you just elbow the guidance out of the way. You know, you can see your angel now, and you put your elbow right in her face, and you just go right to oblivion. So
incoming.
There's has to be a big penalty for elbowing your angel.
Yeah, it's called oblivion. yeah, as if you never had been. Okay, but see, you know, take the, you know, try to look at how it goes beyond, you know, the salvation thing. All right.
These time evaluators are also the secret of prophecy. They portray the element of time which will be required in the completion of any undertaking. And they are just as dependable as indicators as are the Frandalanks and Chronaldecks of other living orders. The gods foresee, hence foreknow, but the ascendant authorities of the universes of time must consult the imports of time to be able to forecast events of the future.
Read that next one too.
You will first encounter these beings on the mansion worlds, and they will there instruct you in the advantageous use of that which you call time, both in its positive employment, work, and in its negative utilization, rest. Both uses of time are important.
Okay. The one thing to note here is very insightful about what all of these Sakanafim are doing as reflective beings. They're reflecting some aspect of God, or the gods. Okay? And the other thing to bring in, the reason I wanted to have both of those paragraphs there, you notice that they're reminding you of, they're giving you a little physics reminder in that last paragraph. That which you call time, okay, you got to remember, you got to let go of all your current, you know, physics notions of time and stuff. Even if you don't think you have them, you do. Okay, time actually is the chronicity of motion. What we're actually talking about here is motion, not time. And they, just like God, can look at the motion of the in the cosmos and see it as a system, you know, see how it all interacts and moves as one. And you can abstract that quote-unquote time element out of it, the chronicity of that motion. See, these Sakanafim are doing the same thing. There is no, you know, ruler of time that anyone, including God, is seeing ahead of. Okay, there is no such ruler. Okay, that we have to let go of that. That's part of the revelation. Let go of that notion of time as being something that, you know, you're here, and then someone sees the future. That, see, the secret of prophecy is that there is no such magical seeing of the future that anyone, quote unquote, is prophesying is doing. Because there is no ruler like that that someone can magically see ahead of or behind on. Okay, these Sakanafim are doing exactly what God does. Now, like I've tried to point out about bringing the future into the picture like this, it's just a calculation. You know the system of motion. And so when you project that system of motion down into what we recognize as space and time, it has, you know, certain spatial and temporal attributes. See, so they see it. So, you know, just they're trying to, you know, you'll see this a little bit later too. You know, to literally appreciate that these daughters of God the Mother, you know, the reflective Mother Spirits in this case, are doing the God thing. They're doing, they're given an attribute that normally only God has. Not a whole bunch of them, just one little particular tiny facet of what God does goes to this Sakanafim, and another one to this one, and etc.
Remember when they say in the first part of the book that all time is present to God at any time? You know, when you're kind of, which is kind of interesting to contemplate on based on what you're saying.
Right, and now that, I mean, the initially way to understand that, you don't even have to bring in the real physics stuff of motion, but just thinking temporally, quote-unquote, that there is an existential eternity where the Father is, which you can initially kind of think of in an analogy, thinking of being alongside time, alongside every single point of time. So if you're in that eternity, and you look to the side, you don't just see one point in time, or you look ahead and see that point in time up there, or look back and see that one back there. No, you see all points in time simultaneously.
At any one time.
You see it timelessly, see? You're in eternity. A timelessness. And you know, you'll understand that after you've become a resident of paradise, because you'll go into existential eternity and back out again.
I happen to have a short visit to existential eternity waiting for Tom to get his learner's permit. But
you mean the everlasting now?
I think you joined me on that existential eternity when he was having his test rating. But the point is...
All right, now, so the solemnity of trust. Let's get that first paragraph, and you'll see where they're going here now with this.
For the solemnity of trust. Trust is the crucial test of willed creatures. Trustworthiness is the true measure of self-mastery, character. These Sakanafim accomplish a double purpose in the economy of the super universes. They portray to all willed creatures the sense of the obligation, sacredness, and solemnity of trust. At the same time, they unerringly reflect to the governing authorities the exact trustworthiness of any candidate for confidence or trust.
Okay. Besides the immediate obviousness of that, about trust directly, the words that they're using, they're trying to guide you to a recognition here. So I want to think the truth through the paragraphs we're going to be reading here now. Why solemnity? Okay, and you notice that they brought it in again in a triplet. They had obligation, sacredness, and solemnity. Okay, what's going on there? Okay, you know, this whole bit about duty, obligation, you know, be given a trust. Okay, you kind of see immediately why obligation would be there. Now think about those three levels that end up being the fourth, fifth, and sixth levels of meaning when you're looking at the levels of meaning. Those three levels that are established by the three cosmic intuitions, and when they introduce those in paper 16, section 6, what do they call those three levels? They call them causation, duty, and worship, you know, bottom up. You know, duty, obligation. Ah, There's three things here. Is that what I'm talking about? Okay, am I zeroed in with the obligation on that associative element? And are the other two is individuality and unity? Well, let's look. Well, sacredness. Okay, sacred, that's a unity word. Right? Think about solemnity. When you have a solemn ceremony, what specifically does that imply? It means there's a whole bunch of details to the ceremony that are all very precisely executed. That makes it solemn. It's the individuality, the precision that make it solemn. That's an individuality word. Can I trust you with the details? Right? That's the question. If you are clueless about details, I'm a unity person. Okay, well, then you're not trustworthy. You're not going to be given anything. Okay? You have to be trustworthy in the details. Can I trust you with the details? There has to be a detail-oriented, and with this quality to it that we call solemnity, okay? It's very special detail. It's important detail. It's solemn detail. Okay, so these guys look like they're about individuality. I'm going to be looking, for a pattern going forward. Okay, especially since they kind of gave me a individuality, associativity, unity triplet, to kind of get me thinking along that line.
In our world, if someone is given a solemn trust in many situations, they open themselves up to being liable in a lawsuit way if they violate their solemn trust.
And what's the one death penalty on the neighboring planet?
Betrayal of trust.
Yeah, right. The government officials that betray their trust, their sacred trust. We got to get back to calling it a sacred trust that a public official is taking on and hold them accountable when they don't. Otherwise, there's going to be nothing.
Comment.
Right. Okay.
With regard to trust, Judas was an interesting study.
Mm-hmm.
It notes that here he was associated with God incarnate.
But it's very important to think about your example of like Jesus putting trust in Judas, or the Most High is putting trust in Lucifer, say. Knowing full well that it was extremely high probability what was going to happen. But they put the trust in them anyway, because we're not supposed to live in Havona. We're supposed to live in a place where trust isn't automatic, and where you have to see if you can respond positively to a violation of trust. The universe is not looking so much at the person who wasn't trustworthy. That's not news. That's a given. There's no news broadcast about a violation of trust on a mortal world. What they're looking at is how do those who are involved respond? If they wholly respond negatively, then it's sad to record. If they respond positively to a violation of trust, the angels don't cry on their paper. This is the key. Can we use our spiritual consciousness to see the perfectingness of someone who's not perfect? No one is perfect. And if you demand a world that's perfect and become more and more bitter and angry over every imperfection that you experience, those who are imperfect in your eyes go on and you die at some point. You come to an end because it's fatal to embrace the negative.
What you say is absolutely true. Nonetheless, you don't necessarily turn bitter, but you do become a step wiser.
And that's fine, because that's the only way. It's the only way you can become wise is through tribulation.
Yeah.
It's the only way. All right, okay, so let's get back here.
On your ancient, you grotesquely essay to read character, and to estimate specific abilities. But on Uversa, we actually do these things in perfection. These Sakonifim weigh trustworthiness in the living scales of unerring character appraisal. And when they have looked at you, we have only to look at them to know the limitations of your ability to discharge responsibility, execute trust, and fulfill missions. Your assets of trustworthiness are clearly set forth alongside your liabilities of possible default or betrayal.
In the open book thing, you know, and to challenge yourself to rethink stuff like Adam and Eve and Lucifer and Judas and whatnot. Okay, those were open books. No surprise there. So what's the truth of those things? That's the challenge. Don't look at them in the perfect, imperfect worldview. Good.
It is the plan of your superiors to advance you by augmented trusts just as fast as your character is sufficiently developed to gracefully bear these added responsibilities. But to overload the individual only courts disaster and ensures disappointment. And mistakes of placing responsibility prematurely upon either man or angel may be avoided by utilizing the ministry of these infallible estimators of the trust capacity of the individuals of time and space. These Sakonifim ever accompany those high in authority, and never do these executives make assignments until their candidates have been weighed in the seraphic balances and pronounced not wanting.
You want to know that reference, quote unquote? Yeah, it's actually flipping it from wanting, you, someone who is found wanting rather than not wanting, putting the balances, writing on the wall, in the book of Daniel, that story about the writing on the wall, the king who was found wanting, that's the quote unquote. Remember how we are referring to Daniel and the capital J Judges, the Ancients of Days?
Don says, oh, that one.
It's
like he knew.
They're pulling that out again, you know, that famous writing, you know. You know, they're just pointing out, yes, this is the way it is on high. They see the writing on the wall with people. Okay.
What's seraphic balance?
No, the seraphic balances. You know, they weighed you. Mm, nope, you're wanting. You know, balances, the scales. All right, so, you know, see, so you have that again, that godlike assessment. Think about all these now, kind of rethink all these, because they're kind of really stressing that. They weren't stressing before. It seemed like really fancy creature stuff that we've been reading about. But just to recognize, no, this is a little facet of definitive godlike consciousness that these angels have. They know things just like God does in that little area. Yeah. And so when you think about angels being these amazing mathematical geniuses, be able to calculate all this stuff, that's the way God does it too. God can calculate the entire infinite system instantaneously, just like one of these angels can do in one little narrow facet. Well, he can do with everything simultaneously.
It's going to be more challenging for him to hold himself out than the calculation stuff.
The calculation stuff is just an immediate aspect of their mind.
So, Chris, this thing here about the mistake of placing responsibility prematurely upon either man or angel may be avoided by utilizing.
Right.
So how do I get access to them? Because I'm putting responsibility work for me. I want to know whether or not I can trust
them. Well, you'll see.
Is that do you think that this is a little bit of a hint that humans who are given responsibility are measured some way before that?
When we get to the end of the paper here, you'll see that they actually bring that up.
Okay, sorry.
Yep. I'll don't let me forget to comment on it, Bob. Yep. All right. So if we had solemnity and individuality, you know, we should be looking for a unity thing. Let me just note, you know, see sanctity of service, sanctity, that's sacred again. Okay, that's the unity word. Okay, so we have individuality and unity.
Five, the sanctity of service. The privilege of service immediately follows the discovery of trustworthiness. Nothing can stand between you and opportunity for increased service except your own untrustworthiness, your lack of capacity for appreciation of the solemnity of trust.
Okay, it's just another thing. You know, if it wasn't obvious, you see, not only do we have this individuality, associative unity thing building, but you notice how they're linking them all together. They went from the imported time, you know, to the solemnity of trust, and you know, they're showing how they build upon each other. Just see how it's building to some crescendo that we obviously are getting to in the end. They're linking these together. How they and again, just you know, here they're bringing up this untrustworthiness. You know, notice what John read there. You know, prematurely upon man or angel. It doesn't say anything about Lennon index and. You know, they're reminding you that, you know, that there's a little bit different thing going on with some of these beings that are, you know, serving a given role as opposed to one of us, sometimes an ascender, you know, maybe taking on some role, you know, but Lennonidex are created to be like planetary princes and system sovereigns and, okay, see, so it's a little bit different issue there. They don't get rejected like we will get rejected if we aren't trustworthy enough. That's part of the system, you know, and a challenging part for our idealism. You know, that how could God allow untrustworthy individuals to have positions of such huge authority? You know?
Well, this is sobering because some of us hanker, well, what can I do to serve, you know? And it's like, well, if I were
are you worthy of?
I wouldn't have to be looking. It would be fine. I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
The truth of your untrustworthiness will set you free from service. Yeah.
If you're getting strong enough inside, you can start to think like Gene is just reminding you there that these are challenges. To not think, well, I'm innately divine. I'm by definition trustworthy. I should be able to be put into any service. You know, that's the third principle of the Lucifer Manifesto, okay? You know, you got to really watch about that self-aggrandizement, you know. I have a little bit of spiritual consciousness, so I've got it all. No, you're on the second level of meaning. You got the first fuzzy sixth adjutant thing happening in your head. Yeah, that's it. All right.
Service. Purposeful service, not slavery. Is productive of the highest satisfaction and is expressive of the divinest dignity. Service, more service, increased service, difficult service, adventurous service, and at last divine and perfect service is the goal of time and the destination of space. But ever will the play cycles of time alternate with the service cycles of progress. And after the service of time, there follows the super service of eternity. During the play of time, you should envision the work of eternity, even as you will during the service of eternity, reminisce the play of time.
Okay, so learn that truth. Because service, endless service, sounds like slavery. You know, that's the first thing that pops into our heads. So I'm doomed to be a slave forever to God. That's the fifth epical revelation. Slavery, more slavery, super slavery, endless slavery. What about me? Okay.
Purposeful service.
Yeah. But just notice what I'm trying to teach you at the end there. Once you get up to the fullness of personality, which you don't have until you come off the Isle of Paradise, then you'll see the true reciprocal relationship. The work of eternity and the play of time are the same thing.
Yeah.
Full true work is what you now think is play. So when you're in the service of eternity, you'll go, oh, yeah, I used to call this play.
Yeah.
But it's actually work. Finally now, on an absolute level of engagement with my personality I'm working. I have this purposing gift from God, my personality. I can finally use it. It's a supreme joy. Okay, you're playing finally. Okay, that's the kind of service and work we're talking about here. Something that is getting ever closer to what you immaturely initially call the opposite of work, play. Or to flip it around and go, huh, so when I'm playing, I'm actually striking step with the finaliters who are working. We're in liaison in some deeply mysterious way. So maybe I should cultivate genuine play. If I can get all of the falseness out of play, I might have a potential to strike step with the harmony, with supremacy in a way I never imagined. You know, that doing something as well as being something might be a little different than I initially thought. Man cannot cause growth, but he can supply favorable conditions. Those favorable conditions are like play. The thing that you're doing is more like genuine play than work, what you're doing. Yeah.
What are you referring to as play? Baseball?
That, no, that's first level of meaning, play. Can you get play up to the sixth level of meaning? That's the question I'm throwing out there. That's what you want to reflect on. What would the word play look like when it's genuine play, when I've gotten it up to the sixth level of meaning?
Yeah.
I know what it's like on the first level of meaning. I have some sense of what it is, you know, when it's really all about the feelings, okay? Can I go above that with play? What does sixth level of meaning play look like? Then I'll know what the work of eternity is like. I'll have my first glimpse of eternity. Okay, let's keep going here.
The universal economy is based on intake and output. Throughout the eternal career, you will never encounter monotony of inaction or stagnation of personality. Progress is made possible by inherent motion. Advancement grows out of the divine capacity for action. And achievement is the child of imaginative adventure. But inherent in this capacity for achievement is the responsibility of ethics, the necessity for recognizing that the world and the universe are filled with a multitude of differing types of beings. All of this magnificent creation, including yourself, was not made just for you. This is not an egocentric universe. The gods have decreed it is more blessed to give than to receive. And said your master son, he who would be greatest among you, let him be server of all.
Okay. You have an individuality, and like I was saying, you're going to have extremely high levels of absolute individuating, you know, way in the distant future. The individuality, yeah, is for you. But yourself is not. Why? Because it's a mindal self. And what is the mindal domain? The associative domain. You know, including yourself was not made for you. Yourself was made so that you had an associative ability for your individuality to reach out to other individuals. Okay. You know, so think about that, you know, in rethinking the work is important, the self is not. Okay. It's not that the individual is not important, but the self is not. Can you distinguish? Okay. The individual is important, but the self is not.
Individual's a lot of work.
Okay.
Talk more about that, Chris. I don't get the difference.
It's part of what they're doing in the fifth epical revelation is separating all those words, separating individuality from self, from personality. Just think about it. Right now it's very easy to understand because I have a material individuality. Okay, I've got three things. I've got matter, mind, and spirit. Okay. I have a material individuality, not a mindal individuality. I have a material individuality. Myself is mindal. Okay, so myself is not my individuality. It's this mindal thing. It's not a material thing. So what's the self about? It's about just exactly what, you know, the threefold actuality says it's about. It's about, it's your means to connect your individuality to other individualities or to the environment. Mm-hmm. For instance, that magnificent unity environment that you're bathed in, to connect your individuality to that unity through its associativity, to connect your matter to spirit through mind. The self is a linking mechanism. And that's why, you know, you need a better linking mechanism when you need higher linkages. So this mortal self is thrown away, and you're given a higher self. And then that one's thrown away, and you go to the second mansion world. And then they throw that one away. You go to the third mansion world. And then they throw that. I mean, those first ones are so minimal in their linking ability that you literally throw them away.
Are you using it in the terms of, in the sense of mind?
It's you have a mindal self. That's what the word self means. We now have it revealed to us that selves are mindal. That's what a self is.
Just think associative. You just think of self.
You have matter, individuality, a material individuality with a mind seated on it. And it's like, well, why do I have a mind? Because you need to be able to connect to other things so that you're not an island universe.
So they're basically using the word self in a different way than we use it.
They're using it in the genuine way. They're using all the words in a genuine way. You have to re-understand every single word that you've ever learned in order to understand the revelation. If you use any word in its old sense, there'll be more distortion of meaning. You'll misunderstand every single thing in the book.
Maybe
so. Yeah. You know, the definite and indefinite articles, maybe you can kind of stick with the way you had them before. But just, you know, yeah, it's that huge what you're trying to do. Oh, okay.
Well, I found what the highest form of play was. Would you like to hear it?
Yes.
Since everybody was asking. Worship is the highest joy of paradise existence. It is the refreshing play of paradise.
Right. See, and that's just another reminder. See, when you get up to that level, everything is play. You're finally allowed to play out your personality. That's the point I'm trying to make. That's what, see, so if you ask, what does play look like when you get it up to the sixth level of meaning? Yeah, I wasn't going to talk about this, but see, I've been trying to hint at it. You're getting up to a full personal level. You're actually allowed to play out. Think about what the word play actually means. Look it up in the dictionary. Look up the literal meaning. To play out your personality. Okay? You start playing out your basic genetics. You play out your mind, higher and higher mind. Finally, you can play out your personality, and that's genuine play. Okay?
Why do you think you want to do it?
Well, John, when you go out to the college and set up your little booth and put a target on yourself for somebody to come by and take heat with you and you talk about the Orange Book,
he doesn't talk to
me. That's the key. He stands back. So no one.
The reason why it's so enjoyable is because doing service in a cosmic sense, in God's sense, is the only thing of any enduring value.
And say that's just, you know, just think about, go back and think about the conversation we had when we were talking about being on paradise. You know, with the primary Supernafim. You know, finally your personality is fully liberated. That's play. Okay.
The real nature of any service, be it rendered by man or angel, is fully revealed in the faces of these seraphic service indicators, the sanctities of service. The full analysis of the true and the hidden motives is clearly shown. These angels are indeed the mind readers, heart searchers, and sole revealers of the universe. Mortals may employ words to conceal their thoughts, but these high Sakonophim lay bare the deep motives of the human heart and of the angelic mind.
Again, open book? Yes. Yeah. Mind readers, heart searchers, and of course, heart, I mean the upper domain of the hourglass, heart searchers and soul revealers, every single nook and cranny. Yep, open book.
Well, one of the interesting things is that your mind plays tricks too, and your mind is, you talk about that, deep motives are not always what comes out of your
mind. Right, yeah, and that, yeah, you noticed that in passing. We talked about that some, the hidden motives there, not the intentions, not what gets into the mind, which can, have some issues. See, right. But and when you talk about, an adjective directly applied to motive, it's an adjective like good. It's that spirit word. When it gets into the mind, then you say true intentions. Mm. That's why, when they talk about Kano, it's good motives and true intentions is his line in there. That difference between spirit and mind. Yep.
The heart refers to the seat of the mind, really.
That's the core of your mind. When they say the word heart,
mind. It's not the feelings. It's not rooted in your. It's not the lower level
of mind. It's not the second level of meaning. It's the upper domain of the hourglass. It's the fourth, fifth, and sixth levels of meaning.
What
that's the heart.
Normally referred to as the intellect. They use the intellect for that higher part of the mind and the.
Well,
yeah.
Okay. They use intellect for the higher part of adjutant mind.
Okay.
Okay, but we're going up above adjutant into the upper domain of the hourglass. We're going up into personalized self, personalized mind, spiritualized mind, the heart, that domain created by the encirclement of the Holy Spirit, that literal capacity, that place. I mean, if you use the word, if you have any other idea in your head when you see heart in your answer book, you're going to misunderstand what they're saying. That's what they mean by heart. They mean the temple within the upper domain of the hourglass.
Okay.
That's what heart means in the book.
But there is some, they do speak about spirit feeling. So when people say feelings.
If you have something up here, it comes down. I mean, we just noticed with mercy. In order to get it down and out, they brought that down to the level of feelings. Mm-hmm. They brought appreciation down to the level of feelings, level two, and put it out. Yeah. I mean, everything engages that, but it's just keeping them separate.
Right.
The heart produces feelings, but feelings aren't the heart.
Right, exactly.
And if you call feelings the heart, no. Okay. Let's get these guys.
6 and 7. The secret of greatness and the soul of goodness. The ascending pilgrims have awakened to the import of time. The way is prepared for the realization of the solemnity of trust and for the appreciation of the sanctity of service. While these are the moral elements of greatness, there are also secrets of greatness. When the spiritual tests of greatness are applied, the moral elements are not disregarded, but the quality of unselfishness revealed in disinterested labor for the welfare of one's earthly fellows, particularly worthy beings in need and in distress. That is the real measure of planetary greatness. And the manifestation of greatness on a world like Urantia is the exhibition of self-control. The great man is not he who takes a city or overthrows a nation, but rather he who subdues his own tongue.
Okay, of course the last, they're playing with Proverbs there. Okay, now, let's get the physics of this in front of you. So, the first thing to notice is, remember how it's been building. We had individuality with the solemnity of trust. We had unity with the sanctity of service. We're probably going to weave them together. What's one of the things that we talk about? As a weave of material and spiritual, individuality and unity, the soul. You see the word soul here. Okay. All right. So we're talking about bringing that in, that super additive consequence, so that you have the full system. Okay, but we have 6 and 7 together. And let's get the physics of this first. Okay, so if you picture a rectangle, Okay, and I've got my finger and my thumb of each hand on the two ends of the rectangle with my finger and thumb on the corners of the rectangle. Okay, so now let's make on the one end of the rectangle, we have the pair of words that actually are directly connected. The words that are directly connected here of these, we have four words: secret, greatness, soul, and goodness. Okay, the greatness of this harmony. See, we've built up to a harmony, this literal greatness. Okay, and the weave, the soul. Okay, on the one end of the rectangle, you have soul and greatness. On the other end, you have secret and goodness. Well, why? Because as they pointed out in there...
It's the other way.
No. No, it's not. I'm going to show you.
Oh.
It's not the other way. Okay.
Patience.
Now, why does the secret... why does the secret go with the goodness? They try to point out, okay, the secret they're talking about is a quality. Okay, the quality of the unity is the secret. Okay, quality, unity, goodness, those are the spirit words. Okay, so like I said, think of this rectangle where on one end you have soul and greatness, on the other end you have secret and goodness, and they've cross-circuited the pairs to make the names. So it becomes the soul of goodness and the secret of greatness. They're about to, you know, that's important to as they're about to explain. Why are 6 and 7 together? Because they are cross-circuited. These angels are cross-circuited together. And they literally do that in their names by cross-circuiting the words. Mm-hmm. Make the harmony words and the unity words. Okay. Now think about this. See what there's. So you have a quantity of harmony, and you have a quality of unity. Okay, greatness, quantity. That's what they're the two things they're bringing together here. Okay. So when you think about the real measure. About that secret that. Quality of unselfishness. Remember how we talked about the fifth level meaning was unselfishness? Well, now they're bringing in a little bit more. Remember those cosmic levels? There's selfishness, and then there's higher unselfishness and higher unselfishness. And there's higher and higher qualities of unselfishness. So again, the first measure of unselfishness is just that, the first measure. There's higher and higher measures. See, and you measure, okay, the planetary greatness by... you know, measuring the unity in the cosmic system. Okay, so another way to think about it, so you have this quantity of harmony. Okay, and the secret that's revealed in the fifth epical revelation about harmony is that it's a tri-unity. There's a secret, a unity secret hidden in harmony. It's a tri-unity. It's not a tri-individuality. It's a tri-unity. This harmony. See, that's what we're talking about here. There's you know, one Sakan of him is focusing on the triunity, the unity of the triunity, and the other is focusing on the harmony directly. One is on the quantity and one's on the quality. That's what's going on here. And now another way that we know the secret. Okay, everyone has always thought that which is perfect is that which is good. And that which is imperfect is that which is not good. And that's all there is to it. No, there's a secret that's revealed to us, a secret of goodness. You know? See, we're talking about secret, but see, what's directly, the secret is directly tied to the goodness part. What is that secret? Out here in the evolutionary domain, that which is perfecting is that which is good. That's the secret. You now know the secret that which is perfecting is that which is good, not that which is perfect. That's in Havona. You're not there.
That which is growing in a threefold manner.
Perfecting spirit. Growth. Yeah, growth. Okay? So this is just a beautiful thing. See how they've cross-circuited the names and everything to link them together? I mean, it's really clever. Okay, and then they're just about to mention this cross-circuiting here.
Why do you think they say this thing about the welfare of the particularly worthy beings? In need and indispensable.
The indispensables?
That cartoon?
No. Up in paper three? I mean that's the indispensable. The inevitabilities, I'm sorry. You know what I'm trying to say. The inevitabilities. Thinking about dispensable. The inevitabilities. Sorry about that. Here what I meant to say, not what I actually said. You know, that whole motive and intent thing. Okay, but yeah, the inevitabilities. That's what they're referring to there. I mean, the greater the contrast, the greater the potential. So, you know, if you're going to have one of that really high quality, it's going to require a very stark contrast to achieve it. You can't achieve that high quality, you know, in Havona. You need to go to the darkest place to do the highest quality.
Reveal the disinterested labor for welfare of one's earthly fellows,
particularly worthy beings in need and in distress.
As opposed to unworthy beings?
And not in distress. Yeah. I came not to save those. I mean, Jesus said this all the time. Right. That's the inevitabilities. Not the indispensable, but it's indispensable too. See, you know, can you appreciate why I absentmindedly said indispensable instead of inevitable?
Yeah.
Because see, it is indispensable to what we're talking about here. You cannot do high things with no differential. That's what those inevitabilities are about. The highest. So for Michael to do the highest thing he can do, he's got to go to the lowest place. Basically everything that happens out here is super Havona, above Havona. Havona people can't do what we can do out here because they don't have the contrast like we have out here. We can do greater things than they can. All right, so let's get to it. Notice how they directly talk about this link together now. It's cross-circuiting.
Greatness is synonymous with divinity. God is supremely great and good. Greatness and goodness simply cannot be divorced. They are forever made one in God. This truth is literally and strikingly illustrated by the reflective interdependence of the secret of greatness and the soul of goodness. For neither can function without the other. In reflecting other qualities of divinity, the super universe Sakonophim can and do act alone. But the reflective estimates of greatness and of goodness appear to be inseparable. Hence, on any world, in any universe, must these reflectors of greatness and of goodness work together, always showing a dual and mutual dependent report of every being upon whom they focalize. Greatness cannot be estimated without knowing the content of goodness, while goodness cannot be portrayed without exhibiting its inherent and divine greatness.
Okay, so just again, they're showing you the way God sees things. You know, when you'll see what these angels do in liaison like this, you're seeing what God does. Not something, you know, that is some downstep. This is literally how God does it. These are, you know, like I was pointing out, that's one of the key things to get to. What are they fundamentally reflecting? They're reflecting the mind of God. You're seeing little facets of the mind of God. Okay, and that's why they brought it up again. I mean, it can't be any other way, because God is supremely great and good, inseparably. So are the angels that are a reflection of God's mind. Up there where we said, and the manifestation of greatness on a world is the exhibition of self-control. You see that brought that exhibiting, again, that, you know, so you have the quality, but you have the quantity that gets exhibited, okay? You know, that's, and again, that's especially understandable for us because we can't see quality, but we can see quantity. That, you know, so it seems it's a very trivial distinction for us. Okay, you know, and again, to just emphasize, so one of them is speaking to the harmony, the other speaking to the triunity. And the harmony is the triunity, and the triunity is the harmony. You can't, they have to speak together. Okay, so that's what we're getting at. And then that even greater secret, that triunity, that harmony is perfecting. That's the truth of it. Okay. And we're doing what we're doing here because we're not thinking the facts. We're going beyond thinking the facts. We're thinking the truth of what's flowing through this. We've recognized the little keys that they've given us here, and we're putting it together. And we now have a truth flowing through this.
Yeah. The estimate of greatness varies from sphere to sphere. To be great is to be godlike. And since the quality of greatness is wholly determined by the content of goodness, it follows that even in your present human estate, if you can, through grace, become good, you are thereby becoming great. The more steadfastly you behold, and the more persistently you pursue the concepts of divine goodness, the more certainly will you grow in greatness, in true magnitude of genuine survival character.
So they're giving you a little clue, because the unity part is always the spark that gets us going. Okay, and again, if it isn't, see, the quality of greatness is wholly determined by the content of goodness. Again, he'll give you.
Yeah.
It should be obvious that we're on the right track here. Okay, and then they throw in, if you can through grace become good. Yeah, hear me bring that up all the time, using that word grace. What are they referring to there? What gift of grace is literally the touchstone of goodness that you're looking for? Is it the Holy Spirit? Not quite. That's the spirit of fact. Is it the spirit of truth? No. It's the spirit of goodness. There's three gifts of grace. One is individuality, one's associativity, and one's unity. Spirit of goodness, your thought adjuster. Okay? If you can, through grace, become good. The more you can identify with the goodness that is that spirit fragment, that adjuster, that will spark the process. It'll catalyze this formation of harmony, and you'll be great. You'll have quantity sparked by that starting point of quality. You know, and quantity is made literal by the adjuster. He puts another brick in your Marantia structure called your soul. Every measure of harmony that's in the upper domain of your hourglass gets made brick of Marantia substance and grows your soul. So that's what, you know, that's why they say grace. Yep.
They're describing why we don't want to waste our time.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, it's again, just notice, I've coined these, names for the full triunity, spirit of goodness and spirit of fact. Why? Because that's the, I'm thinking the truth of it, and they're referring to it almost literally here. See, is the spirit of goodness, that particular gift of grace. Okay, so now let's read their little epilogue here about the ministry of the Seconophim.
7, ministry of the Seconophim. The Seconophim have their origin and headquarters on the capitals of the superuniverses, but with their liaison fellows, they range from the shores of paradise to the evolutionary worlds of space. They serve as valued assistants to the members of the deliberative assemblies of the supergovernments, and are of great help to the courtesy colonies of Uversa. The star students, millennial tourists, celestial observers, and a host of others, including the ascendant beings in waiting for Havona transport. The Ancients of Days take pleasure in assigning certain of the primary Seconophim to assist the ascending creatures domiciled on the four 190 study worlds surrounding Eversa. And here also do many of the secondary and tertiary orders serve as teachers. These Eversa satellites are the finishing schools of the universes of time, presenting the preparatory course for the seven-circuited University of Havona.
Yeah, and again, so I'm reminding you that there's a teacher mode for all these beings outside of these God reflection things that we've been mainly talking about. And, talking about Eversa as the spiritual preparatory school, that's what I'm referring to, that sentence. When you actually are going to put spirit on the floor and build from there, it's what you're preparing to do on Eversa. The little incidentals, remember at the very beginning they mentioned in passing, they couldn't resist reminding you in passing here at the end, they're liaison fellows. There's a whole nother group of angels that, remember, they aren't revealing here. These are daughters of the reflective mother spirits. There's other mothers at the super universe level, creative mother agencies in the ancients of days. That's their liaison fellows. Remember how they said at the beginning that those other angels are working hand in hand with them all the time, And again, those angels and the creative mother agencies of the ancients of days are unrevealed. They're not undisclosed. Okay, the fact is disclosed, but the truth is not revealed. Okay, remember, you got to keep that facts and disclosure, truth and revelation. Got to keep those two separate. They disclose the fact. Okay, can you think the truth that flows through those facts that they've disclosed, that they weren't allowed, to sort of lead you down the truth path of?
Do you suppose these finishing schools have various levels of prestige attached to them? Here we say, well, I went to Cambridge or Oxford.
I went to world number 155. I went to world number 155. There's going to be all kinds of differential amongst those, like you're saying, 490 study worlds.
So we'll all have to get into the best.
Well, of course, they're all best, and whatnot, but some are going to be better for some things than others, so there will be a hierarchy like that. So you can, have that truth of it. The other little fact in passing, in a couple papers we'll talk about star students and celestial observers, but millennial tourists, what kind of millennium are we talking about there? That's the central universe millennium. That's what we call 100 million years. Every 100 million years, there's a bunch of tourists on the super universe headquarters. Anyone remember why? We mentioned it in passing.
Jubilee?
It's every central universe millennium, the seven supreme executives leave the infinite spirits worlds and go to paradise, and Magisthon helps with their whole reflectivity mechanism to put out this, this little celebratory sort of, announcement, and everyone gathers, those are the tourists, everyone gathers to hear it, received on the Eversa in our case. So that's what that's about. Okay.
Of the three orders of Siconophim, the tertiary group attached to the ascendant authorities minister most extensively to the ascending creatures of time. You will on occasion, meet them soon after your departure from Urantia, though you will not freely make use of their services until you reach the tearing worlds of Orvinton. And you will enjoy their companionship when you become fully acquainted with them during your sojourn on the Eversa school worlds. These tertiary Siconophim are the time savers, space abridgers, error detectors, faithful teachers, and everlasting guideposts, living signs of divine surety, in mercy placed at the crossroads of time, there to guide the feet of anxious pilgrims in moments of great perplexity and spiritual uncertainty. long before attending the portals attaining the portals of perfection, you will begin to gain access to the tools of divinity and to make contact with the techniques of deity. Increasingly, from the time you arrive on the initial mansion world until you close your eyes in the Havona sleep, preparatory to your paradise transit, you will avail yourself of the emergency help of these marvelous beings who are so fully and freely reflective of the sure knowledge and certain wisdom of those safe and dependable pilgrims who have preceded you on the long journey to the portals of perfection.
So that's a really cool little disclosure there. You know, you think about all this kind of scary stuff that we've referred to some here recently. You know, it's like, well, okay, I make it off this one, but then I've got all of these scary things looming on the mansion worlds, and can I get the fusion? You know, look at how they word that. You know, avail yourself of the emergency help. So even if you're at a point where it technically is an emergency situation, you know, you could go to oblivion here if you take the wrong fork in the road. You know, they used to have crossroads. if you avail yourself to the help, including this kind of help, you can pull back from such an emergency situation. So, you know, even though the planet's in an emergency right now, you know, it isn't necessarily the end, and it's not the end for you either. And again, you know, see how they're stressing what kind of phenomenon we're talking about here. They call it the tools of divinity, and but lest you misunderstand, to make contact with the techniques of deity.
Yeah.
See, and that's, of course, more technically what we're doing here. It's the mindedness of deity that we're tying into, not so much the personality of God. Because these are persons. See, they're expressions of the mindedness of deity. Okay. Yeah, and you got a question?
Yes, I was, so I was hearing I'm on this, emergency. So, these guys basically, the Trinity, are basically set up so that, they're the fail-safe for if you accidentally elbow your divine face.
Yeah, that's kind of what, yeah, to extend that analogy, you know, that if it really has gotten that bad, where you're not just on a slow path, but you're starting to go seriously astray, you're starting to elbow people in the face you shouldn't be elbowing in the face, you know, there's always the possibility that you could have a little faint flicker of clarity left in you, and you could go, I need help. I need serious help. I need more help than a seraphim can give me. I need a seconophim to help me here. Please, will you help me? You know, and you know, you're going to get the same kind of help as if God, one of the gods, literally spoke to you and guided you, just like you could have gotten 2,000 years ago for a brief little period of time, when you could have walked up and shaken hands with God. You know, but as we saw, even when you can shake hands with God and ask for help, people in the mansion world will reject it just like they rejected Jesus 2,000 years ago when God was made flesh. But, you know, again, the mercy is more than you could ever need. There's so much mercy that even when, you know, one more step and you're gone, they can help you to pull back from even that. If you really want to, right? Okay, and then the last little bit here, which ties to back to John's question.
We are denied the full privilege of using these angels of the reflective order on Urantia. They are frequent visitors on your world, accompanying assigned personalities, but here they cannot freely function. This sphere is still under partial spiritual quarantine, and some of the circuits essential to their services are not here at present. When your world is once more restored to the reflective circuits concerned, much of the work of interplanetary and inter-universe communication will be greatly simplified and expedited. Celestial workers on Urantia encounter many difficulties because of this functional curtailment of their reflective associates. But we go on joyfully conducting our affairs with the instrumentalities at hand, notwithstanding our local deprivation of many of the services of these marvelous beings, the living mirrors of space, and the presence projectors of time. Sponsored by a mighty messenger of Uversa.
Okay. So, see how that's related to your question, John? That normally the celestial authorities would have access to the kind of calculations and assessments that these Sakanafim bring. They don't have it. And so, it's like saying, man, I wish I could have an import of time. Tell me exactly how much time this is going to play out over. Man, that would be handy to know. We're going to have to guess. And you notice, the Revelators even point this out. You have a primary Sapernafim, the chief of Seraphim, talking about his guessing because he doesn't have an import of time that can help him actually calculate it. So he's saying, I'm thinking maybe it's hours or, or days, And Nessa says, no, I think it's going to be at least 10,000 years, And see, that's because they don't have these Sakanafim that could really pin it down precisely, And so they have to work in a lot of trust and a lot of patience mode, And then the other little thing is the little kind of physics of the circus they reminded you of again there. Remember we kind of mentioned that a few spots. They don't really talk much about this linkage between the more literal circuits that are laid out, as conduits, those mind conduits that they make, and then the actual reflectivity presence. But, they're referring to that again, these are reflective angels, but they're not literally engaging it like sort of at eye level, that reflectivity. They have, on-ramp mechanisms that get them up into it. And those are cut off, so they can't get up into it. If they could get up into it, that would make them higher than they are, because the reflectivity literally is just a cosmic presence. It's a cosmic presence of supreme mind. Okay, they're not up there. Okay, they're finite beings. But with this, properly plugged into that cosmic presence of the supreme mind, they can bring deity consciousness down into the finite. So they're always giving you a little hints like that to clear up some things in passing. You want to notice the the physics that's often in passing in these paragraphs too. All right, so there it is. All those spirit origin beings. Seemed like a lot, but remember they said there's a countless number of types even, let alone number of beings. So they give us a little quick survey of the spirit origin beings that have some immediate relevance to the ascension scheme. And now we got the last three papers, which are a block. They seem like three disjoint papers, but they're a set of three. And we'll talk next time about what the final set of papers is in part one here of the Revelation. Let's take a moment.